WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the past 15 years, Americans have adopted over 62,000 children from China. Two of those children were adopted by Jeff Gamage and his wife. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Gamage about his new book, China Ghosts: My Daughter's Journey to America, My Passage to Fatherhood. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Also, we talk with feminist Muslim Asra Nomani. Daniel and Marion Pearl were visiting her home in Pakistan when he was kidnapped. She's one of the people depicted in the new movie, A Mighty Heart. And music critic Milo Miles reviews music from the bands Balkan Beatbox and Golem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Because it's so difficult to adopt babies in the U.S., many would-be parents go to China to adopt. In fact, in the past 15 years, over 62,000 children, mostly girls, have been adopted by Americans. Two of those girls were adopted by my guest, Jeff Gamage, and his wife. Gamage is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's written a new book called China Ghosts, My Daughter's Journey to America, My Passage to Fatherhood. The book also looks at the larger phenomenon of Chinese adoptions. The phenomenon dates back to China's one-child policy, which was implemented in the 1980s to control surging birth rates. Because Chinese culture places a premium on sons, Chinese orphanages were overwhelmed with unwanted girls. China has loosened its one-child policy. If a family's first child is a daughter, they're now allowed to keep her and to try again for a son. Recently, the Chinese government imposed new regulations on foreigners who want to adopt in China. Single people are no longer welcome. There are height, weight, and age restrictions, and you can't be on antidepressants. A few weeks before my guest Jeff Gamage and his wife traveled to China to meet the girl that would become their daughter, they were given a photo of her. I asked him about the significance that photo took on.
It took on vast significance. We'd been imagining our child for so long, and when we had her picture, it just, we put it up everywhere, and Christine and I, my wife, we had constant conversations. It was our only source of conversation was, what is this girl like? What is she doing now? Is she playing with a friend? Is she getting enough to eat? What is she thinking? Does she know that we're coming?
So what was it like to see her for the first time after this one photo? Was all you knew of her for over a year?
Well, for most of that year, we didn't even have a photo. I mean, it wasn't until 5 weeks before we traveled that we were given a photograph and the name of our daughter and the location of the institute where she was living. When we met her in person, it was stunning. It was stunning because we had imagined her for so long. It was like bumping into a celebrity on the street, and you sort of, you've always seen them in your mind or on the movie screen or in pictures in a magazine, but now you see them in three dimensions and they're real and they're in front of you. And Jin Yu, I immediately saw that she was smaller than we expected. She was very thin. Her legs were sticks. She had sort of a cut on her forehead and a mark on her cheek. And she was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen.
Now, you mentioned that when you adopted your oldest daughter, Jin Yu, that she had a cut on her forehead and a scar on her cheek. So the what was going on her forehead near her scalp is what really worried you when you found it. Would you describe what you saw?
When Jin Yu came to us, she was very internal. She was silent and still. And that's not good. It happens sometimes, but usually when the girls come to their new families, they're very upset. They cry, they scream, they act out. And that's actually a good thing because it shows that the child has attached to the caretakers, that the child has the ability to attach and will attach to the new parent. Jin Yu made no sound. She was very still and silent and did not respond to us. And then in our hotel room, after we received her, we found that she had, it doesn't do it justice to call it a scar, it was an injury or a wound on the side of her head that went from her temple to down behind her ear. And we thought she had suffered some kind of traumatic head injury. And at that moment, we sort of saw all our dreams of parenthood and all we imagined and wished for this girl just slipping away, just disintegrating in front of our eyes.
Because you thought?
We thought she had some sort of severe head injury, and that was the reason that she was not speaking or moving or talking.
Well, you might have thought at that point, oh, we wanted a healthy daughter. We were told we were getting a healthy daughter, so we're going to make an exchange.
People around us were making noises about an exchange, but Christine and I felt like this was our daughter. when we were first referred our child, we were expecting a baby. Everyone was saying the requirements that we had met, China sort of characterizes you by age and children in the home and prior marriages, that we were going to get a baby. And we got a two-year-old. So the big question was, well, can we parent a two-year-old? And we said, well, yeah, we can. So that was our point of decision. Whatever came afterwards in terms of Jin Yu's health or abilities, we felt like we'd signed on for that, and we would just have to do the best we could for each other.
Well, you took her to a Chinese doctor in China. What did the doctor have to say?
Not a lot. The doctor said she examined Jin Yu, and she looked at the side of her head, and she ran her through some rudimentary tests for balance and cognition and hand-eye coordination. And she felt that she was okay, that she had not suffered a brain injury, that this was an injury on the outside of her head. And she suggested that it could have come from an infection. In summer, Hunan is scalding in the summer, and the children sweat. And the doctor suggested to us that perhaps she got a bug bite and she scratched it. And as more dirt and sweat came into the wound, it became infected, and that the skin continued to expand and contract and boil and fester, and that this is what caused this scar and this injury. I'm not sure if that's correct. It certainly didn't make me feel any better.
No, because if it's festering like that and they allow it to keep festering, that would be terrible.
Exactly.
So you took her to an American doctor when you got home.
Yes, Leslie Sood, a very fine doctor.
And what was her diagnosis?
She didn't really have one. Leslie has a Chinese daughter of her own, too, now, and she's highly experienced in what can happen to children in orphanages. And I felt like Leslie sort of gave me the hard and unvarnished truth. And what she said was that Jin Yu was fine. She had suffered no traumatic head injury, but there are things that happen in orphanages to children, and you're just never going to get the answer, that the information is simply lost. It's not recorded. You're never going to know what happened to this child, and you're going to have to find a way to live with it.
So how well did she heal?
Very slowly, not completely. That scar will be with Jin Yu the rest of her life.
Does hair grow around it?
It does. She'll be able to cover it when she wishes.
And is it traumatic to her?
She is asked about it. She's asked if other children have one. And she's asked how it got there. And like so much of what we say to our daughter, the answer is, I don't know.
Did it scare you a lot, the thought that you might be taking on parenting responsibility for a two-year-old who could have brain damage? You know, when you thought that was a possibility, you know, I mean, let's be honest, a lot of people who get pregnant and have amniocentesis decide to abort if they find that there's some kind of severe, brain malfunction or deficiency. So did you think, like, this is going to change our lives? This has the potential of changing our lives in ways we're completely unprepared for and we don't want. We would never have signed up for this.
We did think that. But it was scarier in the abstract than it was in real life. Presented with those facts, would you care for a two-year-old child with traumatic brain injury who you know is going to live out her life mostly bedridden in your home and you will care for her 24 hours a day? The answer is, I could never do that. Faced with Jin Yu standing before us, this child who we had wished and longed for, there was no question in our mind that whatever came, she was coming home with us.
And it turns out she was fine.
And it turns out she was fine. Mm-hmm. She sort of slowly emerged. It was almost like she was coming up from underwater. By the end of, I think we were 16 days in China, and by the end of that, she was not outgoing, but she was at least comfortable. She was moving. She was talking. She was accepting food from us. She had begun to blossom.
You adopted a second daughter from China. When you went to China the second time around, did you do things any differently? And did you go with a different, emotional mindset than you did the first time around? Because you were experienced the second time around.
Our second trip was very different, mostly because we had been through our first adoption. We knew it was going to work out. We now had confidence in the system and its ability to deliver our daughter to us. The first time, we were hoping it would work out. The second time, we knew it would work out. The second time, we traveled to Lanzhou, China, which is way out west. It sits in Gansu province. It's north of the Tibetan Plateau and just south of the Gobi Desert. It's very remote. And it was fascinating to see that part of China, but the trip was so easy, and Zhaogu was only 11 months old when she came to us. She was still a baby. Her period of mourning lasted about 45 minutes, I would say, and then she was completely with the program and eager to be with us. The second trip was like a vacation with a prize at the end.
Would you like your daughters to at some point know who their birth parents were? You know, if it was possible to find that out, and it probably isn't, but if it was.
I definitely would. If they wanted it, this was completely Jinyu's decision and Zhaogu's decision. If they wanted me to help them try to find their birth parents, I would. I hope they will. I think everybody has questions about who I am, where did I come from. I expect my daughters will have those questions. I think in the future it might become easier if China continues to open and change. There's no saying what might happen. There could be some sort of DNA data bank where the girls and their parents could register and they could find each other that way. I think a lot about Jinyu's parents and Zhaogu's parents, the Chinese parents, and what they must have gone through and what they go through now, what it must be like for them to have to wonder every day about this child that they lost. And if I could, I would just like to let them know that these children are fine. They're healthy. They're happy. They're loved. So whether it's Jinyu or I or somebody else who brings them that news someday, I would like for them to get that.
My guest is Jeff Gamage. His new book is called China Ghosts, My Daughter's Journey to America, My Passage to Fatherhood. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jeff Gamage. He and his wife have adopted two daughters from China. His new book, China Ghosts, is about adopting their first daughter. We should say, when you started this adventure of going to China the first time to adopt your first child, you didn't even particularly want to be a father.
I did not want to be a father at all. I didn't think I'd be a very good one. It wasn't a job I was interested in.
Yeah, why not? Why didn't you want to be a father?
It's hard to articulate, but I felt I was doing things that I enjoyed, that I had all this free time, that my life was one of going to Phillies games whenever I wished and Eagles games and movies on the weekends, and Christine and I could go out to dinner at a moment's notice and we could travel the world if we liked. We had a very nice life. I did not see any need to interrupt that life with the demands that I knew a child would impose.
So were you becoming a father basically to please your wife?
Yes. Christine wanted children, and my wife has always done for me, and I felt that if this is what she really wants, then she should have it. And we attempted to have biological children. We could not. And then we moved on to adoption.
So what changed your mind about being a father and made you actually really happy with the idea?
I don't know that I was really happy with the idea until we got Jin-Yoo. I was accepting of the idea and willing to give it a go. But until we got Jin-Yoo and I could see her and see how funny she is and how good she is and how smart and what a joy she is and see how lucky I am to have her in my life and her sister in my life, that's when I really felt that I could be a dad and I could maybe be a good one.
You write in your book, it's disorienting to discover that the thing I never wanted, a child, is actually what makes me happiest. Why do you find that disorienting?
Because it makes me question everything else, that all the other opinions that I so firmly hold. If I could be wrong about something as crucial as this, I could be wrong about anything. So it just made me reevaluate sort of all the decisions I'd made, and maybe I really don't like the Phillies. Maybe I'm really a Mets fan.
Do your children ever ask about their birth parents?
Jin-Yoo has started asking recently. She, for a long time, would tell us that she was born from one of her nannies, that she was carried in the belly of one of her nannies. And we would gently correct her and say, no, you were born to a woman in China, and we don't know where she is, but that's how you were born. She started asking again more recently. She asked us where. She said, where is the woman who gave birth to me? And the only answer is, I don't know. We tell her about circumstances in China and the one-child policy, but she's not asking for a dissertation on China's birth planning policy. She just wants to know her story. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of good answers to give her.
How important is it to you that your daughters learn about Chinese culture?
It's crucial. And it's okay with me if later on they decide they're not interested. As a parent, I'm always trying to think of what I'm going to be blamed for and what I can live with. Because I figure when she's 16, Jin-Yoo is going to say, you dragged me to every Chinese cultural event, and boy, I hated that. Or she's going to say, you never took me to any Chinese cultural events, and why didn't you? And I would rather be blamed for the former than the latter. I would rather try to do my best to give her whatever culture and connection I can than to give her none at all. But the other thing that worries me is that I may be connecting her to a vanished culture, that historical China is not modern China. Being Chinese in China is not being Chinese-American in this country.
Do your daughters speak any Chinese languages?
Very little. Jin-Yoo, when she came to us, was babbling in Chinese. And at night, she would sing herself to sleep with these little lullabies that someone must have sung to her in the orphanage, just beautiful little songs in Chinese. And that's gone now. When she first came to us, we tried to keep that language up. But it was difficult for us because we didn't know the language, so we could not reinforce what she was learning effectively. But also it began to feel too much like work, like another day of school for her, and she was sort of being pushed into this class and made to learn this language. So I'm hoping she'll go back to it. For right now, we're more concentrating on sort of cultural information and historical and family information.
When you came home with your first daughter, after adopting her in China, you were angry about a lot of things. Tell us about some of the things that made you angriest and about what you did with all that anger.
I found having two daughters from China is a very curious place to live your life, because when we came home from China, I felt that I had been fundamentally changed as a person. Certainly my daughter had changed and been changed, but I felt that I had changed too, and that while I was aware of only this, no one else was aware of it at all. I was angry that my daughter had spent 2 years in an orphanage. I was angry that she had lost her biological family. I was angry that a system of orphanages had become normalized in China. And at the same time, I was so deeply and eternally grateful to the Chinese for allowing me to have this child. They didn't have to do that. They could have kept Jinyu for themselves, and they didn't. They trusted me to raise this child. So I felt I was in sort of this strange place between being very angry at the people to whom I was also extremely grateful to. And I find that really hasn't subsided, that sometimes the longer we have Jinyu and the more she blossoms, the angrier I get about what she was forced to endure as a child, and the more grateful I am to China for allowing me to have my children.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jeff Gamage is the author of China Ghosts, My Daughter's Journey to America, My Passage to Fatherhood. He's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Asra Nomani about her friendship with journalist Daniel Pearl. He was kidnapped while staying with Nomani. We'll also talk about how she became a feminist Muslim and advocated for changes in her mosque. Also, music critic Milo Miles reviews bands that play a postmodern blend of klezmer, gypsy dance, and Turkish wedding music. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Asra Nomani, is one of the people depicted in the new movie A Mighty Heart. Through her work as a Wall Street Journal reporter, she became friends with journalist Daniel Pearl. He and his wife, Marianne, were staying at Nomani's house in Pakistan when he was kidnapped. Nomani was born in India and grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia, where she now lives. She's Muslim, but she's also a feminist and has advocated for women's equality inside and outside the mosque. She's the author of the memoir, Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She'll be a professor of journalism next semester at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Let's start with a scene from the film A Mighty Heart. Nomani and Marion Pearl are trying to find Danny Pearl, who was kidnapped after setting off for an interview with a radical sheik. They're talking to a man who knows the contact that helped Danny set up the interview. Asra Nomani is played by Archie Punjabi. Marion Pearl is played by Angelina Jolie.
I'm really sorry about Danny. Have you heard any news?
No. Can you tell us what you know?
Danny wanted to meet Gilani. We went with Arif, and we spoke with Bashir Gaimon.
Who's Arif?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? How did you meet him?
I got his number from a friend of mine.
Okay, so who's the friend?
I can't tell you.
You can't tell us? Why is that? Is that because they paid you for Danny? I mean, like, how much did they pay you for Danny?
I was doing my job helping Danny.
I don't think you understand how serious this is, huh? We need that name to find Danny. Danny is missing. He may be able to help me find him. Okay? I need the name.
I promised him. Mafia, give his name.
Do you understand? Do you understand that maybe you can make the difference of helping Danny or nobody finds him?
Asra Nomani, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with what you think of the movie A Mighty Heart.
Well, Terry, it was really hard for me to see. It was a really difficult movie because I felt as if Danny had a cameo in his own murder. He, you know, was the reason why the movie could be made, and yet he didn't come to life on screen. You know, I don't have any fantasies that we're going to get Danny back on the big screen or anything like that. But the friend that I knew in this lifetime wasn't visible up there on the screen, and I just felt like it was such a tragedy.
Now, Daniel and Marion Pearl were reporting from Pakistan when he was kidnapped, and they had just come to visit you. They were staying at your house when he was kidnapped. So your home became the center of activities for the search to find him. Did you trust the Pakistani police and intelligence agents who were in your home trying to find out what happened to Danny Pearl?
Well, you know, I've always been a journalist all my adult life. I have the same kind of skepticism that any journalist would have of anybody in a position of authority. I didn't fully trust them, but I knew that we needed them. And so there was a cooperation that I've never experienced before, and journalists rarely do with anybody who's in law enforcement. With the intelligence agents, it was particularly difficult because they were a particularly dodgy, nefarious kind of personality, and I felt like, you know, they were playing as many games as helping us, and so that was always like an issue where you felt like you were kind of playing chess.
There's an incredible part of what was happening in your life while Danny Pearl was missing that the movie doesn't touch on at all, which is that while he was missing, you found out that you were pregnant.
And, yeah.
Go ahead.
I didn't know it, but the day that Danny disappeared, I was a week pregnant probably, and I discovered that I was pregnant into the third week of Danny's absence.
Who is the father of your baby, your son?
Yeah, he was a man, a Muslim man that I fell in love with on the banks of the Arabian Sea in Karachi. He was part of the Karachi elite, working in Karachi, living there. And I thought that this was for real. And so the day that Danny disappeared, you know, I found out the truth in terms of the his ability to take the risks that were going to be necessary to stick around.
Was he scared off by the police?
He was. I mean, the Pakistani intelligence, he told me, came to visit him immediately the day that Danny was reported missing. I had put his phone number and his name as my contact when I picked up a account for my mobile phone in Karachi. And so doing their research and investigation into me, they found him, visited him, and asked him to spy on me and what was happening in the house. And he came over then that first day, and he told me, I cannot come around anymore. And I told him, you have a choice. You know, you can stick with us. You can stay with us and help us, or you can leave and run away. And he said, I've made my choice. I must go. And I was mad. I wept quietly, you know, in a corner of my house, and had to wipe away the tears to continue to try to find Danny. And now, so many years later, away from that sense of betrayal and anger, I understand. I mean, I understand that in Pakistan, you can disappear. Your family can suffer for years, and your entire life can be turned upside down if you get too involved in an issue of controversy.
You've said the two defining moments that shaped your relationship with your religion, Islam, were the murder of Daniel Pearl and the birth of your son, Shibli. About the murder of Daniel Pearl, you wrote, the men who plotted the kidnapping of my friend did the five daily prayers that are on the five pillars of my religion, and the men who killed my friend did so in the name of my religion. How did having your son affect your sense of Islam?
You know, when I learned that I was pregnant, I was afraid. I knew that according to the most puritanical and strictest interpretation of Islamic law, I was a criminal because I had had sex without a wedding ring on my finger. I knew that my son could be used as the evidence of my crime. In Pakistan, they had put into place laws called hudud laws, which literally represent, you know, a moral crime. And in Pakistan, it is a crime to have sex out of marriage, not much unlike Western culture of years ago. So what I was confronting at that time and during my pregnancy was this question of whether I would even bring my son into this world. I had to contemplate having an abortion so that I could be a good girl, you know, according to this definition of Islam. It was during my pregnancy when my parents told me very clearly that they loved me and that they loved the life within me, that they guided me to a place of kindness and compassion and love that I think is the best expression of any religion. And then when I came back to West Virginia to have my son, I was told very clearly by a midwife here that I had to prepare for only one thing, and that was my son's delivery. So when I went in to the delivery room, I didn't know how I would respond. And when I was told that his heart rate was dropping and that we had a difficult situation there, all I did was turn to my prayers of protection that I had learned in Islam. I turned to faith, just as I had when I had learned that Danny had been killed. I turned to those same prayers for protection, and I said, Allahu, Allahu, which is an expression of the divine outside and inside. I was trying to bring life to my son, and when he emerged, then I knew what I felt was the best in the expression of divinity in seeing his face, and he brought me new life.
My guest is Asra Nomani. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Asra Nomani. She was born in India and grew up in Morgantown, West Virginia. It was while making the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, that she learned about the historic importance of women in Islam and started thinking of herself as a feminist. When you returned home to Morgantown, West Virginia, you were really unhappy with the restrictions on women in the local mosque. What were the restrictions?
Well, when I came back from Mecca, I was really excited about the place that I could have in my faith. And so a new mosque opened up. My father had been one of the founders of our mosque in Morgantown, and I was really excited about becoming a participant. I walked up to the front door of our mosque, and an elder stood in front of me and said, "Sister, take the back door." And he was expecting me to take this wooden stairwell on the side of the mosque to the back door and go through a back staircase into a balcony where I would then sit and stare at a wall with the preacher down below in the main hall. And so as women, we were basically told to sit in the back, take the back door, and stay quiet.
And what was your approach to protesting this second-class status?
Well, that first night, I walked through the front door because that's where I was headed. But I didn't go into the main hall. And for 10 days, I sat in the balcony. And it was in the balcony of my mosque in Morgantown that I became a feminist. And then I talked to my family. And so finally, one morning, we went as a family at the dawn prayer time. And we walked into the main hall and prayed. I mean, it was that simple. We simply just took a place behind the men and prayed. And after that, all hell basically broke loose.
Were you threatened?
Yes. That morning we were told very clearly, "Sister, it's better for you upstairs." That night I returned and a gang of men surrounded me to tell me to go into the balcony. As I decided to take a public stand about this, I realized that we'd struck a raw nerve in our community that depends on women having second-class status, and death threats came in, and every tactic of intimidation that all people have known on any issue. And we stopped getting invited to the potluck dinners in our local Muslim community.
So did things finally change at your mosque?
Yes. We had, for the first time then, women elected to position. Women started coming more regularly. I ended up with my mother most days, just her and me alone in the main hall, because the message was sent loud and clear through the community that good Muslim women did not go into the main hall. And so it was a pretty lonely experience and has continued to be in our local community. But globally, we've had a significant change. All of the major Muslim organizations have come out now defending and protecting the right of women to go into the main halls. In San Francisco, the mosque leaders at one place tore down the wall behind which women were expected to sit. And so what we've had is an incredible shift in our position about where women fit in mosques in our Muslim world.
You're about to start teaching journalism at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies, and you're going to start there something that you're calling the Daniel Pearl Project. What's the project?
Well, for 5 years since we learned that Danny had been killed, I have wanted to know the truth. I mean, everybody who is part of his life, his family, his friends, they recognize that we don't know the full truth. We don't know who the people were that murdered Danny. We don't know why they killed him. We don't know who paid for the plot in which he was kidnapped. And we have to find that truth, I think, if we're going to understand this moment that has become iconoclastic in world history. And so what we're going to do in the Pearl Project is have 20 students, 10 undergraduate and 10 graduate students, working together to try to solve this mystery and also draw a lesson from it. Because at the end of the day, I don't think Danny would want this just to be about him.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has kind of claimed responsibility for masterminding the Danny Pearl kidnap plot. do you not believe that he was behind it?
Yeah, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has confessed to actually being the person who killed Danny. And so we now have Condoleezza Rice, Alberto Gonzalez, President Musharraf, all putting that story out there. And none of the investigators who worked on the search to find Danny and who have tracked his killing have found any convincing evidence to link Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to Danny's murder. It could be true, but at the end of the day, so far, it's a story that's been put out there by politicians to, I think, give us closure. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed may have his own agenda in making this confession. The governments involved may want this just to go away. But at the end of the day, we really don't know whether he was the man who killed Danny.
When you knew Danny Pearl, he's Jewish, but I think he was, you know, kind of non-practicing. Am I right about that?
Well, Danny was definitely Jewish and definitely, you know, like a lot of us, cultural in our practice.
Mm-hmm.
He took me to a synagogue once for Yom Kippur, and then we left early because it wasn't that interesting.
Did you, and you were struggling about whether you wanted to be a Muslim, stay in the faith or leave the faith. Did you talk about religion a lot with him?
We never talked about religion. And I think, you know, that's telling in itself, because we were in a place as journalists where we were passionate about making the world a better place and using journalism as our vehicle for that. But we also spent a lot of time talking about our really pathetic love lives and the fact that, you know, we were both striking out miserably on the dating scene in Washington, D.C. When he met Marianne, he sent me, you know, this list of 100 activities that he planned for this weekend trip with her, and I helped him whittle it down to 10. And you know, that's what we spent our time talking about, and how we were going to basically, you know, get stories past our editors at the Wall Street Journal that we, you know, stories that we really cared about.
Did you ever think that you and he would be in Afghanistan after September 11th and in Pakistan after that?
When September 11th happened, I immediately emailed Danny, and we both knew that we were going to head to Pakistan. I was on book leave from the Wall Street Journal and went over there for Salon magazine. Danny went over there for the Journal. And I think that, you know, that same quality that brought us together as friends, you know, two kids of immigrants who came from very, very different roots, is exactly what brought us both to Pakistan. You know, in our friendship, we belied this concept of the clash of civilizations. And in our reporting, we were so trying to bring some kind of understanding between the Muslim world and the West. Danny had known the Muslim world very well through his reporting. I knew it through my life. And we knew it was much more complicated than the story that people were trying to spin. And so when we both ended up there, it was, I think, just complete natural extension of the people that we are and were, and the kind of work that we wanted to do.
Well, Asra Nomani, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Asra Nomani is a professor of journalism at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Her memoir is called Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Coming up, Balkan fusion music. This is Fresh Air.
gypsy dance groups, Turkish wedding bands, and klezmer ensembles may be unlikely models for a pop movement in the 21st century. But critic Milo Miles says that these older styles have been taken up by a new wave of young bands who enjoy mixing the old ways with the latest rock, funk, and hip-hop.
Back in the mid-60s, there was an American Bandstand spinoff called Where the Action Is, which went around the country filming teen scenes that were hot. It seemed to me ever since then that if you listened widely and diligently, you could tell where the action is in pop music. And right now, I think it's in gypsy fusion bands. This is a wildly eclectic style that began with the klezmer revival of the 80s, picked up steam when Eastern European gypsy wedding bands finally began to tour the United States, and really took off a few years ago when DJ Eugene Hutz formed Goggle Bordello. That and like-minded groups now voraciously blend punk, hip-hop, and techno, as well as folk styles from all over North Africa, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. Two of the finest performers are Golem, whose debut, Fresh Off Boat, came out late last year, and Balkan Beatbox, whose second album, New Med, just came out. They invite everyone in with the track Hermetico. Here we go, go, you better listen. The BBB train riding on a rhythm. We know they're hungry, so we better feed them. Skip the boat and give the summer up. Pick up your clapping hands and pay attention. From the Middle East to the open nations. We coming straight to your ear, no complications. As yella yella, come on, give me summer up. Give me summer. Golem offers a more cabaret storytelling style of gypsy fusion and is fronted by singer and accordionist Annette Ezekiel. Balkan Beatbox goes for the all-out worldwide rave-up mode and was founded by drummer Tamir Muscat and saxophonist Ori Kaplan. Most important, though, both groups feature wildman vocalists who seem to be members of the extended Borat family. That is, guys who are sometimes crazy like a fox and sometimes crazy as a loon. Aaron Diskin does this duty for Golem. DJ Tomer Yosef rouses the rabble for Balkan Beatbox. Yosef has an edge because the hip-hop element in the group allows him to get into flat-out rapping. And you have to love a guy who starts a show by cueing a rooster crow and saying, "There is only one rule. When you hear the chicken, make some noise." I'm the digital monkey. Supply the frequencies and beat the rhythm that's funky. I come from Middle East but don't belong to no country. I jump from tree to tree, put my track on CD with a BBB. All the ladies in the place make me feel sexy. I got that style, you go get the taxi. I drive this town to get the trash to the fancy. Red street to the lens, I'm the monkey on the MC. I smoke the lala, we're gonna take it hala. I smoke Shakta Vayala, the highest on the scala. Velala, la, 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 li, li, li. So bring the dance and leave the guns and take it up all the way to Washington, D.C. Balkan Beatbox delivers a dance blowout with taste as broad and boundless as the internet. One number they suggest a mutant Turkish wedding band, thick with horns. The next a Bulgarian women's choir come down with a case of the funk beats. On New Med, the quick changes always feel road-tested at live shows, and Balkan Beatbox never forgets a pop verity. If you do politics and protest and party, make sure the party comes first. And not the communist one, either. As opposed to the in-this-moment Balkan Beatbox, almost all of Golem's material is from folk sources, though you would never know it. Not just because the players attack the music with punky joy, particularly Alicia Jo Rabins on violin and Curtis Hasselbring on trombone, but because singers Ezekiel and Diskin bring a certain oversex neurosis and big-city angst to their performance. The message is that the music is from the old world, but they're not. A refreshing quality shared by Golem and Balkan Beatbox and the Gypsy Fusionists in general is that they don't have the tense relationship with traditional music that many early eclectic pop groups had. What to do? Uphold tradition? Expand tradition? Trash tradition? The Gypsy Fusionists suggest the best answer is to make your own.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed Fresh Off Boat by Golem and New Med by Balkan Beatbox, both on the J-Dub label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Remember, you can download podcasts of Fresh Air by going to our website, freshair.npr.org.
Support for NPR comes from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Dial Press, publisher of The Archivist's Story by Travis Holland, a tale of suspicion and courage set in Moscow in 1939. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tim Weiner talks about the newly declassified CIA papers, the family jewels. His new book is a history of the CIA. And we talk with Brad Bird, the writer and director of the new animated film Ratatouille, and comic and actor Patton Oswalt, the film's star. Join us for the next Fresh Air.